Boffman versus Commonwealth, Jonathan S. Jeffress, Emily Voschel, William Zapf, Appellant's Counsel, Michelle S. Callen, Solicitor General, K. Scott Miles, Deputy Attorney General, Brittany M. Jones, Deputy Solicitor General, Aaron Wheelton, Senior Assistant Attorney General, Suzanne Bielaski, Assistant Attorney General, Laura H. Cahill, Assistant Attorney General, Appellee's Counsel.
All right, appellant, you may proceed.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Goodwin. My name is Jonathan Jeffress, and I represent the appellant, Galen Boffman. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
All right.
The jury's verdict in this case came after a trial process that was infected by fundamental errors. Those errors went to the heart of the SVPA's protections for respondents and to Mr. Boffman's rights under the due process clauses of the Virginia and United States constitutions. It thoroughly subverted the carefully constructed process the General Assembly set forth for proceedings under the Act. Before discussing the individual assignments of error, I want to correct an erroneous legal assertion from the Commonwealth's brief. On page 5 of its opposition, the Commonwealth asserts that someone who is designated a sexually violent predator can eventually be declassified under Section 914. That is incorrect. As set forth at footnote 2 of our brief, of our reply brief, although a respondent's conditions can be lessened or even largely eliminated, the respondent's designation as a sexually violent predator is for life. It is permanent. Once designated an SVP, the Act provides no route for ever ridding oneself of this status and the stigma of being a sexually violent predator. It is a severe and lifelong consequence that makes the importance of compliance with the Act's procedural safeguards in the first instance, which did not happen here, all the more essential. Mr. Boffman's first assignment of error concerns the Attorney General's blatant expert shopping in violation of one of the most vital procedural safeguards the General Assembly legislated in the Act. And that is what this court in Harvey versus Commonwealth described as the Act's non-adversarial model, quote, for the presentation of expert testimony.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. Do you consider the 904B designation point as a substantive requirement under the statute?
No, Your Honor, I think it would be, it is certainly a procedural requirement under the statute. And I think the important aspect for our position is that, you know, the cross-references in 906 and 908 ensure that it is applied at both the probable cause hearing and a trial.
So the reason I asked the question is, and forgive me if I missed it in your brief, but 1.5 sections later in 905.1, the General Assembly has this one sentence, two sentences, the provisions of section umpty-ump and 37.2904 and umpty-ump are procedural and not substantive or jurisdictional. Absent a showing of failure to follow these provisions as a result of gross negligence or willful misconduct, it shall be presumed that there has been substantial compliance with these provisions, end quote.
Yes, now, right.
Is that statute relevant to our discussion? Because it is referencing 904, and that's where you get your main argument from.
Yes, and the Commonwealth has not cited that provision in its briefing, nor did it cite that provision in the lower court, in the circuit court.
Well, it's conspicuous that your main argument is a page and a half away from this provision, and you don't cite it either. We obviously can't ignore this statute. So no, what's the answer to it?
I think, Your Honor, in light of the fact that Dr. Gravers, the expert who was properly designated under the Act, came to the conclusion that Mr. Boffman was not a sexually violent predator and did not qualify for classification under the Act. This is a substantive and procedural problem, but certainly it goes right to the main issue, which is that, you know, did he qualify? Could he be properly designated? He could not be, given Ilona Graver's opinion.
The point I'm trying to get at, I think, is just the wording of 905.1, which is the General Assembly is saying, unless you're charging someone with willful misconduct or gross negligence, it shall be presumed that there's substantial compliance with, among other statutes, 904. That sounds like to me the General Assembly is saying, don't get all, you know, tied up around the bootstraps on this stuff. You know, be reasonable and be commonsensical about it, which follows closely the contextual argument being made by the Attorney General. But it worries me that neither of you cited the statute. It's right in the middle of the code. It's obviously relevant. And we're talking about it for the first time now on appeal.
Yeah, you know, they didn't cite it, Your Honor. I don't think either of us think it applies here.
How does it not apply? It's referencing 904, which is your whole argument on the designation point.
But this is not some technical noncompliance with 904. This is expert shopping. It is the rejection of an expert opinion who was properly designated under the act that would have led to the termination, most likely led, I think, and I think the Commonwealth concedes this, to the termination of proceedings at that point.
Okay, let's assume for the sake of argument, 904B was not technically followed as you interpret it, which is a highly debatable question contextually. It flat out says that we shall presume there's substantial compliance in the absence of willful misconduct or gross negligence. You're not asserting and have never asserted willful misconduct or gross negligence. So it's not a substantive or jurisdictional rule. And substantial compliance is all that's required. And you're the appellant. And you're not even addressing the statute that apparently addresses the heart of the question, which is what do we do about an argument that there is some deviation between the language and the intentionality of the language?
Well, to be clear, Your Honor, I think, you know, willful misconduct, I wouldn't phrase it that way, but that is what we're talking about here. This was a very deliberate decision to discard the expert who was properly designated under the act in compliance with the procedures that the General Assembly meticulously legislated because of her opinion, because her opinion was not to its liking. And then they went expert shopping, went out, ultra virus, found somebody on their own who with no grounding in the statute.
But did the trial court have an opportunity to review the willful misconduct charge and to examine the evidence and make a factual finding? Because willfulness and misconduct are very mens rea-like issues. It's not just it didn't happen, so we can presume they were willful. But I don't know, you correct me if I'm wrong, if the 905.1 point was even raised in the trial court.
No, because there's no other explanation. Dr. Gravers was fully available to testify at this trial. There was no allegation that she did not somehow not qualify. So the only explanation for, you know, kicking her to the curb was her opinion. Was her opinion that it was in favor of Mr. Boffman. There is no other technical.
Why can't the explanation be they disagree with your interpretation of 904B? Not that they're misconduct or willful or malicious or sanctionable. They just don't agree with you. And they think the other statutes contextualize the point quite adequately.
And I think
that willful misconduct.
It depends on this court's interpretation of 904. If this court holds, as the statute states, that the expert must be designated by the commissioner, that's a qualification in order for them to testify at the probable cause hearing in a trial.
But I don't follow the logic of that. In theory, we could say, the other contextual statutes don't change the word designation. But that's not the same thing as saying you're guilty of willful misconduct. It's just saying we disagree with you, which I'm not sure I'm implying, but nonetheless, how does that constitute willful misconduct or gross negligence?
There is a case that's not cited in either of our briefs about the provision that Your Honor is referring to, and that's Warrington versus Commonwealth, 280 Virginia 365. And in that one, what happened was the expert evaluator who was designated by the commissioner in accordance with the statute found that the respondent was a sexually violent predator. However, what happened then was, is the Commonwealth found out that he did not meet some of the other qualifications with respect to his track record for evaluating these cases and so forth. So they went out and went back to the commissioner, which is what they can do. And the commissioner appointed a second expert. And that second expert came back and rendered the same opinion as the first expert had, and they filed an amended petition. And the issue in Warrington was whether that fell under what Your Honor is referring to with 905, with you know, substantial compliance and everything. And the court said that did. You know, basically, there was no substantive disagreement with the expert's opinion. It's just the Commonwealth realized that the expert didn't have the right qualifications. And so they went to the commissioner and did it properly and had the commissioner designate someone else. That's an example of that part of the statute in action. And if that was this, then I'm certainly, I'm sure but the Commonwealth would have cited that action, would have cited that provision of the statute in defense of what happened here. They did not, because this was, they replaced her for no other reason than a substantive disagreement with her opinion.
And was there a factual finding in Warrington by the trier of fact that there was willful misconduct in that strategic decision by the Attorney General's office?
No, it wasn't a I think they did it properly there. And there was a, there was not compliance with the statute in that the first expert who they had based the petition on did not have the right qualifications. So they went back, they asked the commissioner of DBHDS, which is the agency with subject matter expertise, to designate a new expert, which he did. And they then used that expert's opinion to form the basis for the petition. Now that is doing it wrong. And the fact that they found out that the first one was not qualified, that is falls under the provision that, and that is exactly what the provision of the statute that Your Honor is referring to is made for, is something like that, some technical noncompliance. It wasn't done on the basis of a core procedural protection under the Act, which is that the expert is designated by the commissioner and has that degree of independence. So if that expert reaches a conclusion contrary to what the Attorney General wants, well, they're stuck with that. That's what the General Assembly legislated. That is.
May I ask you a textual point about 37.2908C?
Yes, Your Honor.
That's the trial provision. And it talks about an expert meeting the qualifications set forth in subsection B of 37.2904 or 37.2907.
Right. Yes.
And those are different.
Yes.
And there's an or there. So your argument is 904 says commissioner, you have to be on that list. 907, which is incorporated by reference, doesn't have that language, and there's that or. Just help me with that textual point.
Yeah, that's a very important aspect of the statute that indicates that our interpretation, the plain text of the statute governs. Because what they're doing there is they're saying, okay, for the Commonwealth's expert, they must comply with 904. I mean, I'm sorry, yes, with 904. For the defense's expert, they have a different cross-reference. Now, the only difference between the list of qualifications at those two at those two cross-references is that the one for the Commonwealth must be designated by the commissioner, whereas the one for the defense, they drop that qualification. It has the other four, that they're not a member of the CRC, all the other ones, but it does not have that the person must be designated by the commissioner, because the General Assembly did not think that the commissioner should have to the respondent's expert. But what that tells you, Your Honor, what that tells the court is that they very much did mean for the fifth qualification to apply to the Commonwealth's expert. Or if that wasn't the case, then they would have just said, if that was not a real qualification as the Commonwealth contends here, then they would have just used 904 cross-reference. They would have said, okay, the expert for both sides has to qualify under 904. But they did it differently. They did it very carefully.
The text, and that's plausible, but the text says any expert, and you can meet the, for this is for the trial, not probable cause, not the initial CRC determination. It says any expert, you can either be 907 or 904.
Right.
So textually, I mean, what you're saying is plausible, but doesn't it bump up against that language of any expert? In other words, not the Commonwealth expert, you got to do 904. Defense expert, it's broader.
Well, I don't know if that does any work, because ultimately they're saying the trial expert for the Commonwealth under that cross-reference has to be designated by the commissioner. So it can be any expert who's designated by the commissioner.
Counsel, why are you limiting it, following up on Justice McCullough's question, why mm-hmm. are you limiting that language in 908 to the trial expert designated by the Commonwealth or the trial expert designated for the respondent? All the language says is if they meet the qualifications of either 904 or 907, any expert may testify. So why doesn't that support an argument that an expert who meets 907 can testify for the Commonwealth at the trial?
Because 907 is all about the right to the assistance of experts for the respondent.
That's what 907 is about, but the qualifications for the expert are everything that's in 904 minus the designation by the CRC.
The two lists of qualifications are coextensive, except for the fact that the one in 904 adds the extra qualification that they must be designated by the commissioner. So they must be meeting that, they must be going with what these sections are about. And 907 is about the right for the respondent to have an expert. Doesn't have to be qualified by the commissioner. Doesn't have to be designated.
Why must they be going about what the sections are about?
Well, I mean, 907 is, the whole section is about the defendant's expert. It's about, the respondent's expert, the respondent's right to expert assistance. And so it only makes sense that when they're putting those two things separately, they're saying, okay, this is 907, this is the one for the respondent, 904, this is the one for the Commonwealth. In any event, the cross-reference is clear that for the 904 expert for the Commonwealth, it has to be one that meets all five qualifications.
Mr. Jeffress, this is Justice Kelsey again. You're familiar, I think, with the Wynn case, 2009 opinion that the court issued?
Yes.
Does that ring a bell? It's very interesting that when we decided to lay out in a single sentence the qualifications test under 904B, we omitted the designated by the commissioner phrase. We put ellipsis there. Now, presuming courts, make decisions and write with a degree of due care that we expect the legislature to, that seems sort of conspicuous that the court was signaling that this is a different thing. This is just a selection thing. It's not a qualification as such. Because if it were, we would not have specifically omitted the one phrase you're talking about. So I know that's a little bit of a tea leaves thing, but it's something we've got to think about. What do you have to say about it?
It would contravene exactly what the Act was trying to do here by placing the Commitment Review Committee and then, more importantly, the Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Services, the agency with subject matter expertise, at the heart of this Act. And this court in Harvey relied directly on those provisions and said that this is not, that, and relied on the non-adversarial model for the selection and presentation of expert testimony as saving it from a due process challenge.
Isn't Harvey different in that it was a conditional release hearing under 913 as opposed to a trial under 908?
That's correct, Your Honor. But that's not how this court discussed that issue in Harvey. The court discussed it as under Virginia's SVP framework. They were discussing it the entire thing. Furthermore, there's no indication in the text, there's no indication in the structure that they would have somehow had one model for conditional release hearings, which was the non-adversarial model, but then had an entirely different model for the more important issue of the trial and whether someone is adjudicated a sexually violent predator in the first place. The statute has one model for the selection of experts, and it's the most vital procedural protection under the Act for respondents.
Counsel, I've got to interrupt you again. When I hear you say, as you have said, and very persuasively, that it is essential to the entire paradigm of the statute, that it is the heart of it, it protects due process as a core requirement. And then I get to 905.1, and it tells me, no, it's not procedural. It's not substantive. It's not jurisdictional. And absent some willful misconduct, we shall presume, not it may be presumed, we shall presume all you got to do is substantial compliance, which is, in other words, you may not throw it through the hoop, but you're going to bounce it at least off the rim. So, if this protection were as core as you advocate it should be, why would 905.1 include 904 in it? Why wouldn't it say, except for 904B, because that's absolutely core.
This is the exact opposite of substantial compliance, Your Honor. This is taking an opinion, a favorable opinion to Mr. Boffman by the expert that was properly designated, and discarding it, burying it, in violation of the statute because of the nature of the opinion. That is not substantial compliance. That is the opposite of substantial compliance. That's doing it based on the conclusion that the expert reached. And this goes right to the heart of the due process issues that we've raised as well. In Chivet versus Commonwealth, the case that this court held, the SVPA survives constitutional scrutiny, a constitutional challenge. This court specifically pointed to the expert provisions and to this non-adversarial model as a reason why it survives challenges to its constitution.
So if 904B didn't include the designation phrase, this statute would be unconstitutional under due process?
It's not just there. It's reincorporated through the cross-references and everywhere else. What they sought to do is to provide a degree of independence to the expert. And this court has recognized that. You know, in Harvey, they said this expert, this court said, the expert is not the prosecution's expert or the defense's expert. That expert may conclude over the objections of the attorney general that the respondent is amenable to release. You know, the whole point is that you have this neutral expert. It is a critical safeguard. This is the main psychological expert in a case that turns on a psychological question about the defendant's mental health. It is basically the entire ball game. If you have an expert who is beholden to the attorney general for his appointment, for his money, to get paid, those are things that the General Assembly clearly did not want to happen with respect to this statute, proceedings under the Act. It is a sea change in proceedings under this Act. This Act has worked the way that Mr. Boffman represents it, interprets it to work for the last 18 years.
Counsel, the party in this case is not the CRC. The party in this case is the Commonwealth of Virginia, and the Attorney General is the lawyer for the Commonwealth of Virginia. So I'm struggling to understand why you think that that is a bias issue. It's necessarily part of the adversarial process. Why wouldn't the Attorney General have the ability to make his or her own judgment as to what's in the best interest of the Commonwealth, his client?
Because as this court has said, where a statute lays down express qualifications for an expert, those qualifications must be followed. That is what this court has said. And the General Assembly made a different choice here. They made a different choice from what typically in most civil and criminal cases. And they did it for a very good reason, which is to provide for, you know, this is already a process that has been challenged constitutionally and has survived it, but it survived it precisely because of the procedural safeguards that states have put into the statute. The United States Supreme Court in Kansas versus Hendricks said it only will survive constitutional scrutiny if there are proper procedural safeguards. This is the procedural safeguard, the main procedural safeguard.
Okay, you've answered my question. Thank you very much, counsel.
Right. Your time is up, counsel. Commonwealth.
All right. Oh, you can't hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Brittany Jones here today on behalf of the Commonwealth. The question before this court is not whether the Commonwealth is cherry-picking its experts. It's whether the Commonwealth is required by statute or the U.S. Constitution to use an expert appointed by another agency to perform an initial confidential evaluation to determine whether or not to bring SVP proceedings. And it is whether Mr. Boffman may demand relief from this court despite his intentional decision not to participate in that statutory process. The Sexually Violent Predator Act does not require the Attorney General to rely on the expert appointed by the commissioner at trial. The phrase designated by the commissioner does not refer to a substantive qualification that the Attorney General's expert must possess in order to testify. It refers to the way the committee selects its expert.
Ms. Jones, let me ask a question because you said it doesn't require the Attorney General to rely on that person at trial. First question, we're talking in this case both about the probable cause hearing and the trial, correct?
I think, Your Honor, that my friend on the other side has only challenged the introduction of Dr. Swander's testimony at trial, but I believe she was permitted to testify in both proceedings.
Okay, I'm a little confused by that. I thought we were dealing with both, and so, okay, so you're just focusing on the trial. Thank you.
Dr. Solinger herself has served as the commissioner's selected expert in over 50 cases in 30 courts. And we think the best textual evidence of the meaning of the term qualification comes in section 904F. That provision indicates that where the committee determines it needs additional experts to complete its review, quote, the commissioner shall appoint such qualified experts as are needed, end quote. If qualified means appointed by the commissioner, as Boffman argues, this provision makes no sense. It would circularly require the commissioner to appoint an expert that he or she has already appointed. As to the colloquy my friend on the other side had with Justice Kelsey, we do think the presumption of compliance in section 905(1) applies here. The statute tells us that where there is ambiguity, we presume compliance. We don't think you need to get to those sort of tiebreaker canons because the language and context are clear. But if you do, Section 905.1 would break that tie in the Commonwealth's favor.
This is Chief Justice Goodwin, Ms. Jones. You say that there's ambiguity. There's no ambiguity about compliance here. They clearly did not comply. What ambiguity is there?
Your Honor, we did comply in the sense that we appointed an expert that satisfies the qualifications listed in 904 and 907. There's no dispute about her underlying qualifications. The only dispute is whether the term designated by the expert, by the commissioner, is a qualification that Dr. Schollinger needed to have. And we don't think that it is under the statute.
But counsel, we, one thumb on the scale is that we've said, because this is a quasi-criminal scheme, we strictly construe the statute. So plausibly, you don't have to be on the commissioner's list. Maybe you do have to be on the commissioner's list. Wouldn't that canon of construction put a thumb on the scale against your argument?
I think, Your Honor, the court has previously said that lenity applies in this context. However, where you have a specific provision of the statute that says you need to interpret the statute to presume substantial compliance, that statutory canon would supersede the lenity canon. And I think that Justice Kelsey is correct that Section 905.1 refers specifically to Section 904. And so in that context, the statutory canon would supersede lenity. Again, we don't think you need to reach any of these canons, but if you did, I think 905.1 would be the primary canon. Due process likewise does not require the Attorney General to use the committee's expert. In criminal cases every day, the prosecution relies on experts that the prosecutors themselves retain.
Can I stop you right there, counsel? Isn't that the whole nub of this thing, is that this is not a criminal proceeding? You're right, every day the Commonwealth is allowed to go out and get whatever experts they want to try to convict a particular individual. But in this particular statute, isn't there supposed to be, as we say, a non-adversarial process when we're just trying to figure out whether or not this particular person, who automatically is going to be screened to determine whether or not they're a sexually violent predator, whether or not it should proceed to a hearing concerning the probable cause to believe that they are?
Your Honor, it's true that the initial review process, we agree, is not adversarial, but I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that the actual SVP proceeding itself is intended to be non-adversarial. I think that's something that Mr. Boffman's counsel sort of manufactures out of his interpretation of the statute. But I think that's the entire question in this case, is whether his interpretation of the statute is the correct one. This court has never before said that the initial SVP proceeding is a non-adversarial process. It's true that in the nine...
Let me ask you this question. Do you think that the Attorney General can shop for experts until it finds one to say somebody is a sexually violent predator? And if you're an aggressive prosecutor, that's what you're supposed to do, right? Is find an expert to support your case. So is that the way the Attorney General office is supposed to handle these cases?
No, Your Honor. I think the Attorney General's office is supposed to make a determination on the front end based on both its own review of the record and the committee's review and recommendation as to whether it's proper to bring these proceedings. And to be clear, in this case, when the Attorney General's office asked Dr. Schollinger for her opinion, it didn't ask her to come up with an opinion that they could use at trial. It asked her to give her a true and neutral professional opinion as to whether or not Mr. Boffman satisfied the criteria. And I think they had reason to do that in this case. It's important for context that there was another SVP proceeding that predated this proceeding, and in that case, the committee's expert had opined that Mr. Boffman was a sexually violent predator. So they
right.
had,
and a jury had ruled that he was not. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But they had that initial expert's opinion, and then in addition to that, a pretty serious probation violation that involved grooming of several 16-year-old young men. And so, sort of with that background, the Attorney General's office was well within its rights to think that this case required a second set of eyes, which is what it did when it asked Dr. Schollinger to review the case. And I also think it's important to remember here that Mr. Bachman doesn't have a great leg to stand on when he talks about expert shopping, because he also asked the court to appoint an expert for him. That was Dr. King. And then he disregarded that expert in favor of an expert that he privately selected without informing the Commonwealth.
Well, can I interrupt you for a second on this expert shopping principle and due process? I'm not following the logic of some of the argument, because in the criminal world, where due process is at its core, because we're taking away liberty and even at the point of capital punishment in some cases, the prosecution, of course, can look for experts to find out a different opinion from the opinions they've previously been given. Civil commitments are not at that level of criminal due process protection, which is why we don't require proof beyond a reasonable doubt. So it seems to me your argument is an a fortiori argument. If there's no due process violation for a prosecutor to do what is being characterized as shopping, how in the world could it be a due process violation for a civil case, even though a civil case involves substantial liberties? Obviously, criminal cases involve more substantial liberties.
That's correct, Your Honor. We don't think there's any room for a due process argument in this case. I think the only way that Mr. Bachman gets where he's going is if the statute requires this sort of regime. And for the reasons I've mentioned, we don't think that it does. If there are no further questions about Dr. Solinger, I'll move to Drs. Krueger and Gravers. Mr. Bachman also takes issue with the exclusion of these experts, but after consulting with counsel, Mr. Bachman refused to participate with both Dr. Gravers and Dr. Solinger. And as this court has held in Ferrara, as a matter of basic fairness, courts generally will not permit a litigant to engage in gamesmanship by refusing to cooperate with the other party's expert while tendering evidence from their own expert. This sort of thing happens in discovery disputes all the time.
Yeah, so I know we made that statement in Ferrara, but in Ferrara, the facts were a little bit different in that the respondent there wanted to be interviewed by his expert, have his expert prepare a report and present that evidence when he had refused to cooperate with the Commonwealth's expert. In this case, what I understand Mr. Bachman wants to do is have a records review, just as Dr. Solinger had a records review. So it doesn't seem to meet the gamesmanship prong of Ferrara. Is your basic argument that the trial court in its inherent gatekeeper role could preclude this evidence as a matter of discretion?
Yes, Your Honor, that is our basic argument. But I would also point out that in Ferrara, it actually wasn't clear whether or not the initial expert had done an in-person interview or not. The initial expert in Ferrara was also a commissioner-appointed expert who had evaluated the offender in previous SVP proceedings. And the court actually doesn't say, I tried to look back in the record, whether or not he had participated in those review processes. And I think the reason it doesn't say it is because that wasn't a relevant factor as to whether or not the trial court had discretion to exclude this sort of evidence as a sanction for non-compliance with the statutory process. I mean, essentially, you have a statutory obligation to provide this sort of evidence to the Commonwealth, and Mr. Bachman has refused to comply with that obligation. And in that context, this court has said that trial courts have discretion to use the sanction of evidentiary exclusion. And again, this is something that does happen regularly in discovery disputes. So we don't think it's anything particularly unusual in this context. And to the extent we're talking about due process here, again, is there a question? To the extent we're talking about due process, I would also add that this decision as to whether or not to participate in the process is entirely within Mr. Bachman's control. He's the one that holds the cards here. And he's the one, I mean, we talk about fundamental fairness and an even playing field, but again, it's Mr. Bachman who has initially made the playing field uneven by declining to provide evidence that he is statutorily required to provide. So we don't think that it is evening the playing field by then allowing him to take advantage of that decision and introduce sort of comparable testimony to the Commonwealth. The whole point is that he is supposed to face sanction for his failure to participate in the statutory process.
But he has faced the sanction established by the General Assembly, and that is that an appointed expert will not be able to testify. So the sanction that the General Assembly envisioned has been imposed.
Well, Your Honor, I think that's actually another problem with his argument, because essentially what he's saying is that you, an offender in his position wouldn't be allowed to take advantage of a court-appointed expert, but would be allowed to take advantage of a privately hired expert. So you're saying that only offenders who have the means to go out and hire their own experts have the right in this context to expert testimony. And
unfortunately, that's part of how our system works in all arenas.
Well, Your Honor, we don't think that that's what due process would require, and we don't think that the General Assembly would have thought that in this context, the trial court wouldn't have the discretion to exclude a similarly situated privately appointed expert. And we don't think that's what this court held in Ferrara. I think it's also important to note sorry, Your Honors, I'll move to the summary judgment arguments if there's no further questions. The experts. Mr. Boffman next argues that the evidence in this case fails as a matter of law to support the jury's verdict. But Mr. Boffman fails to note the extensive evidence presented in this case. The Commonwealth presented 12 witnesses who testified to Mr. Boffman's unlawful and inappropriate behavior with minors, spanning from the time Mr. Boffman was himself a 14-year-old to the moment his probation was revoked for inappropriate contact with multiple 16-year-olds when Mr. Boffman was a 32-year-old man. The chat records in this case speak for themselves, and I would urge the court to review the conversations that Mr. Boffman was having with Paul, a 16-year-old boy who had recently lost his best friend in a tragic accident, and compare them to the conversations Mr. Boffman was having as a college sophomore with 13 and 14-year-old middle school boys, many of whom were struggling with their sexuality. The parallels are obvious, and the jury had every reason to conclude that the only reason Mr. Boffman would continue to contact young men in violation of his probation was because he had an inability to control his predatory behaviors. Mr. Boffman's res judicata arguments also fail for at least two reasons. I realize my time is about to expire, so I probably don't have time for those two reasons, but unless the court has any other questions, we ask the court to affirm the jury's verdict in this case.
Thank you very much, counsel.
Mr. Chief Justice,
yeah.
I realize, I believe that the respondent is out of time, but may I ask a foundational question?
Of course.
Counsel, I may have too generously read your pleadings. What is your argument with regard to Dr. Schulgender's testimony that it should not have taken place at trial, or that it should not have been allowed at both the probable cause hearing and trial?
Sorry, for Your Honor, for us, it's that it should not have been allowed at both. Certainly, at trial, it's you know, that is the critical event here in this process, and that's the most egregious of the violations, but it should not have been allowed at either one under the way the cross-references worked into Section 904.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice.
Yes.
Thank you.
On assignment of error number two, just briefly.
I believe your time is up. So I think both sides' time's up, so the argument is concluded. Thank you all both very much.